on Life.
Good evening and a very happy Sunday evening to you. If you're a regular listener to this programme, you'll know that over the last few weeks we've been thinking about how we can strengthen our local churches. We've been following that theme because too often we think about what the church can do for us rather than what we can do for our churches. That really does sound like a rather famous quote from President John Kennedy's inaugural address delivered back on January the 20th, 1961. Do you remember it? Ask not what your country can do for you, but rather what you can do for your country. Well, delete country, insert church. Of course, one way that we can strengthen our churches is just by actually showing up. The dreaded COVID, sorry to use the cursed word, it meant that we were forced to stop attending churches in person for a while, and many of us have just got out of the habit and never gone back. But there's more to church than just placing our bodies in the building on a weekly basis. So tonight, let's think a little further and discover that we can be a blessing, we can strengthen our churches as we're passionate about our faith, but not misguided in our zeal. We'll consider the power of simple encouragement and then check to see if we're helpful congregants or stifling control freaks. And I'll introduce you to three people that I've met during my travels that perhaps can help us practically as we consider how we can strengthen our church. How can we strengthen our churches? Well, one way is to be passionate but not become zealous critics. The moment I set eyes on one particular man, I knew that I was in trouble. He was a religious smart missile. An intuitive alarm in my head wailed a warning. He was locked onto me and was closing in fast. Zealous Christians don't walk, they march in strident resolution. I braced myself for impact. His jaw was set, his face was grim, his eyes wide and ablaze. He collided without an introduction. "I'm deeply concerned about the spiritual health of this event," he said, the syllables staccato and crisp, his brow seemingly furrowed by years of practiced frowning. "I'm prayerfully concerned that people here are more interested in having fun than they are in seeking the living, holy God." He paused for breath, and I knew what was coming next. Some passionate Christians are gunfighters for God, quick on the draw with biblical bullets. "First Peter calls us to holiness," he continued, "not levity. I'm deeply offended by the frivolity that is going on here. God is surely grieved." Deep inside, I sighed the sigh that sweeps through my soul like a tsunami when every now and again I want to abandon Christianity once and for all. My despair wasn't created because this man was nervous or even hostile about laughter, because we're all different, and he doesn't have to enjoy humour as I do. And it wasn't that I was worried that he'd joined the ranks of the frozen chosen types who carefully arranged their facial muscles to look like they're in great need of bran. My drowning sensation was created because I knew that once again I was talking to a passionately committed Christian. A crash helmet might be advisable. Passionate Christians, they can be highly dangerous. I've reached this awkward conclusion after too many years of pastoral leadership. Most of the church tribulations that I've witnessed have been created not by nonchalant inquirers on the fringes of the church or by casual Christians who treat their faith like a weekend hobby. No, the uncomfortable truth is that I've seen people wounded, churches split, and lives ruined by sold-out, white-hot, do-or-die zealots. Of course, I'm not calling for mediocrity. Christian discipleship is a passionate business, an invitation to die that we might live, a radical call to follow the Jesus whose stomach was turned by the lukewarm deeds of the Laodicean church. But our passion can so easily become infected and turn rather ugly, and none of us are immune. Misguided zeal is an equal opportunity virus, and it often strikes when a Christian begins a blinkered obsession with a single issue. Before long, they become monochrome extremists, every conversation a campaign speech. Their concern might matter greatly, but soon it matters exclusively. The fire-breathing judgmental type insists that God is trembling with anger, his finger permanently poised above the smite button, and insists that the language of grace is disguised liberal compromise. There's the charismatic warfare warriors who love to rebuke something somewhere before breakfast and seem to believe that God is a 10-pin bowler, judging by the number of times they fall over during prayer ministry seasons. The social activist who sits arms folded in the worship service, nostrils flared with indignation, dismissing adoration as pious irrelevance. And don't forget the fervent intercessor who prays mightily but quickly judges those that don't gather for the early morning prayer meeting. So, if we want to strengthen our churches, let's be passionate disciples, and that means passionate learners. Let's listen and not rant or dismiss those who disagree with us as lesser mortals, pathetically impoverished because they're not as deep as us. Let's read books written by those we disagree with and finish the book to find out if we really disagree. Let's realize that we can be wrong, and we often are. Meanwhile, the agitated complainant was insisting that God was prepping thunderbolts to hurl in my direction, and all because I didn't share his point of view. So I tried to introduce a little warmth to the conversation by proffering what I thought was a witty quip, which was like cupping my hands around a piece of frozen chicken. That guy was not for turning, or smiling, or thawing. The man fiddled with his impossibly tight tie. His Sunday morning church attire was slowly strangling him. For a long moment he stood silent, and then at last spoke to me without actually looking at me. His unsmiling face chilled words that should have been warm. "I need to thank you for your ministry, Jeff," he whispered hesitantly, apparently studying a fascinating object that hovered 3 foot above my head. He continued, "But then we give God all the glory, don't we? I wouldn't want you to get proud, Jeff." I thanked him, and so wanted to deliver him of his constricting tie and of his hesitancy to encourage. I wanted him to know that Christian leaders are more likely to succumb to despair than to conceit, but he quickly fled, leaving me with a sad realization. In some churches, there's a famine of encouragement. Faithful, hard-working souls live in the suffocating atmosphere that pervades when appreciation is rare, working hard in the hope of a final well done that will come when all is said and done. They live shriveled lives in the meantime. Starved of words that might just spur them on, they hobble on. The assumption is that serving God is reward enough, which is quite wrong, because the God we serve urges us to encourage one another. Encouragement transforms, energizes, and empowers, as the recent World Cup games repeatedly demonstrated. The fans were the genuine all-rounders of the matches, remarkably making a huge impact at every event. Commentators chattered on about their support. The players looked wide-eyed, and some even sobbed as the crowd roared their support. The deafening choruses of encouragement acted like adrenaline, urging spent muscles and weary hearts on to greater exploits. So why are the fans the X factor that help spur teams on to soccer glory? More than a wall of noise, surely the crowd meets the player's primal need that we all share, to be noticed and to be approved of. As children, we crave the eye and encouraging words of a parent as we wobble on our bikes, bring home the chaotic painting, or use a toilet successfully. And encouragement is the fuel that can lift our heads through our darker days when the valley is filled with shadows. This was poignantly demonstrated at one 3-day event, a triathlon of sorts involving incredible physical stamina, steely mental fortitude, and emotional staying power. The demands were huge, and so a team huddled together the night before the event, and their prospects weren't looking good. They were exhausted before they started, and then the next day the home crowd turned hostile. They switched allegiance, dumped their national hopeful, and cheered for a champion from another land instead. And their chant was an ominous betrayal. "We have no king but Caesar." crucify that man. And so, on Transfiguration Mountain, the voice of the great encourager spoke loud and clear, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." That voice had spoken before, just before another battle, this one for 40 days and nights. "This is my beloved son. I am pleased with him." And so, spurred on by that encouragement, Jesus lived. Urged on by that familiar, encouraging voice, Jesus died. So let's go ahead and make someone's day. Catch them doing something right. Search out the soul who's usually taken for granted. Thank the ticket collector on the train. Smile at the traffic warden. Write a note to that Sunday school teacher who has told the big, beautiful story to countless squirming six-year-olds for decades. Some of them are in their 30s now, but few have come back to thank her. Win a gold medal as an encourager. And then let's know how to receive encouragement too. Some Christians go into panic mode when they're confronted with warm appreciation. A lady approached a minister and thanked him for his sermon, which sent him into a spluttering disclaimer with much pointing to the sky. "Don't thank me, madam. No, please, the Lord did it. Give him the glory." Her reply was insightful, if not terribly encouraging. Well, actually, it wasn't that good. I turned and looked at the man, and at first glance, he looked rather ordinary. I had no idea that he was so immensely powerful, and I glanced again. Scanning the otherwise responsive congregation as I preached, he stood out like a very sore thumb. Seated six pews back on the left, the place where I later learned he always sits, his pew, he didn't look happy. Finding his stony expression disconcerting and battling an anxiety that I'd uttered something heretical that had offended him, I made the mistake common to many preachers as I tried in vain to draw him into my sermon. Hoping for the merest hint of a smile or even a nod of affirmation, I looked his way for a few moments as I spoke, but he just stared straight ahead, arms folded and locked, a grim statue of a man. Then it dawned on me that I was not the only one interested in his expression, because a good number of the congregations were listening to me, but had one eye on him. Some were actually leaning forward to catch a glimpse of his reactions, and I wondered why the fascination with him and his facial arrangements. And that's when I realized that they, like me, were tensely waiting for a cue. Obviously, quite a significant player in that church, this man's opinion was esteemed, his influence heavy, and so his response to this new speaker, namely me, was a matter of great importance to almost everyone in the place. And so if he looked unamused, then their expressions turned frosty. If he appeared concerned, raising a perturbed eyebrow or offering even a hint of a frown, then where his eyebrows went, others followed. Whatever he did, they followed suit. I guess that if he had smiled, then they would have relaxed, sighed with relief, and smiled too. I said, I guessed, because he never did get around to smiling. Inwardly, I made a diagnosis, which later conversation proved to be right. He was a baron. Barons, you'll find them everywhere. In every social context, committees, parent-teacher associations, clubs, families, and, of course, local churches. Barons, they're control freaks on steroids. They like their coffee, their homes, their marriages, and their churches to be neatly arranged around their preferences, their environment neatly folded to their precise specifications. Some are recognized leaders, most are not, but all of them certainly know how to get people to follow them. Barons will use a variety of tactics to get exactly what they want. Some are gifted exaggerators, spinning stories of mass discontent to create fear, and often they claim to represent the majority, insisting that they have a mandate for their opinion. Everyone's leaving the church, they say. Some control by undisguised bullying. If they're leaders, they yell that any dissent is divisive disloyalty and that an opinion contrary to theirs, well, it's a betrayal and an insult to their integrity. Still other barons use quiet, meek stealth, controlling as they don an apparently fragile demeanor. concerned that confronting them would destroy them, everyone creeps around them and the sound of crunchy eggshells underfoot is really quite deafening. And then there are the baronial control freaks who use syrupy pleasantness to get their way. They smile, seem impossibly kind. To cross them would feel quite wrong. So nice are they. And church barons, well, they have the ultimate weapon, the G factor. G for God. When control freaks produce the God card from up their sleeve, they usually hold a winning hand. When you insist that God has spoken to you or that you're surely representing what he thinks, you play the ultimate trump card. Barons may be powerful, but they're not usually brave in battle. When they're in danger of losing an argument, they often cancel the conversation by jumping up and walking out. This is an ingenious device because it gives the impression that they're being highly principled in their retreat when they're actually just running for cover. So what if it's a cowardly stunt? Whatever works. Barons, perhaps you know one. Perhaps you are one. Meanwhile, back at the church where I was preaching, the baron sat rigidly unmoved and the people around him were becoming tenser by the moment. Barons don't bless, don't strengthen. They agitate, create anxiety, wound and hurt as they insist on their way. I'd met a baron and the encounter taught me this. I don't want to become one. Let's not be barons. Let's be builders, strengthening our local churches. Thanks for joining me. See you next week. Lucas on Life.